Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staker. Happy Halloween, everyone. In honor of the spooky season, this hour of Fascinating Ohio is all about the macabre. We're talking with Ohio native R.L. Stine about a life spent giving kids goosebumps, a local production of the Rocky Horror Show. But we begin with horror novelist Tim Wagoner. The Dayton, Ohio native has won multiple Bram Stoker Awards for his spooky stories, both real and not real. His penned novelizations for famous horror series like Alien, The X-Files, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and this one. That music, appropriately enough, is from the Halloween movie franchise. Welcome to All Sides, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me.
How did you first get into writing horror?
I've been a horror fan all my life. One of my earliest memories is being 4 years old and sitting in this little tiny rocking chair my folks had got for me right in front of the TV and watching Universal's Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And I was absolutely fascinated that, because I knew in general these characters existed, but I had no idea they could be in the same world. So I thought it was awesome. And I just from there, loved horror all my life.
What moved you, though, from being a horror fan to a horror writer? When did you know you wanted to write your own stories?
I was making stories up, you know, all my life in a lot of ways. It just never occurred to me to make it a career. And then I was in high school, I was probably about 16, and Stephen King had just come out with The Shining, and he still wasn't so famous that he wouldn't show up in, like, comic book magazine interviews. And I read an interview with him, and I just stopped for a minute, and it was the first time I realized that a human being could choose to be a writer. I'd never really connected the names on the books to something I could do. So I just wandered down to talk to my mom, and I told her I'd like to be a writer. And she just looked at me and said,
"Okay,
I think you'd be a good one."
That's great. Although I understand that you did write a story so disturbing that another parent called the cops on you? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I wrote a novel called Pandora Drive. And I'm not sure how the woman found it. She was in Florida, and I'm not sure why she read it, if it would disturb her so much. But it did disturb her, and she wrote a letter. She sent it to the police in Dayton, and they talked to the dean at the time. And the dean's like, "He's fine." And the police said, "Okay." And the dean held on to the letter, said nothing to me about it until he retired. Then he sent it to me, and I was just shocked. I actually felt bad for the woman because she kept apologizing. You know, he's probably a fine person, but just in case he's a psychotic murderer, I want to make sure the kids at Sinclair are fine. So I actually put it on my blog if anybody wants to go find it.
Oh, that's hilarious. Although you never know, was it Where the Crawdads Sing? The woman later became like accused of murder herself. Mm-hmm. So maybe sometimes, but usually not. I'm sure you're just perfectly fine.
That's what I tell everybody.
In another interview, you spoke of loving to pretend to play, using action figures, acting out stories with friends. Did you ever act out scary stories with your friends?
Oh, sure. We would do all kinds. And I'd also, you know, just do it on my own. I would have like these elaborate scenarios for some of the characters that would go on for like, I don't know, days and days. It would be like a continuing saga. It was just always imaginative play of one kind or another was always important in my life. So, you know, I tried to be an artist for a while, but it took too long to draw. I could say things faster with words, so.
You also had a pretty scary event when you were 9. You almost drowned.
Yep. Yes, I did. Rocky Fort, I think's the name of it. Yeah, and went back there after 50 years, too. And so I could, like, tell the lake, you know, haha, good luck. You didn't get me. It was pretty rough. And it showed up in my fiction over and over again. I try not to write the same exact thing, but water stories show up a lot.
Yeah, you've said water is a great place to hide. Mm-hmm. It's a great metaphor for horror. Yeah, spooky water is all throughout horror.
Yeah, and it's scary in a lot of ways because it's like this very thin membrane between two worlds, and it looks like it's solid until you plunge right through it, or something can come up from it, you know, to get you.
Yeah. You've written a lot of stories, more than 60 novels, 8 collections of short stories, and 2 nonfiction books on how to write spooky tales. What does a process look like for you? Like, how do you begin to conceive of an idea?
Well, I write a lot of stuff down on the notepad apps on my phone of anything that I might see. So last night I had to do a run to the grocery store. And at the window, I thought my little dachshund was watching me. And then I get home and my wife's like, no, she was in the bedroom with me the whole time. She never left. And I'm like,
That's unsettling.
So, you know, dachshund silhouette or whatever, ghost dachshunds on my notepad app. And so what I do when it's time to do a story, I go through and I look and I try to find an idea like that. Then I try to find maybe something else from my own life. And then I try to find some kind of emotional core. And so I put like an observation, a weird idea, and some kind of emotional core together and try to grow a story out of that.
You've also written novelizations of famous franchises, like I said at the beginning, Halloween. How much creative freedom do you get in writing these, or are there specific guidelines you have to follow?
There are. Well, for a novelization of a movie, the movie people often aren't involved in it all that much. It's usually a licensing person at the studio, but sometimes they are. I did recently the novelizations for Ty West's X trilogy. And Ty was like, you can't add anything. So, you know, it's his baby. I understand. That was no big deal. And then I also am doing the novelizations for the Terrifier movies. And they were like, yeah, we want 100,000 words. And I'm like, I'm going to have to make up half of that book. You understand
that? I was
going to
say, that's a lot of words.
Yes.
That's a fantasy novel length.
Yes. And so I just did it, and they were perfectly happy. So you never really quite know what you're going to get. But in general, as long as you're true to the story, they're perfectly happy if you make stuff up, as long as it's not, like, you know, too strange.
Yeah, it sounds like sometimes you get to really expand the universe and sometimes maybe just push around the edges.
Right, and you can definitely expand the characters and get into their emotions and accentuate any themes that the filmmakers have.
Movies are very visual, but books are really about interiority. So
right.
It's just a different way of experiencing the character.
Right.
Do you have any dream franchises or movies that you would like to partner with?
Oh, you know, I grew up watching Star Trek, so I would love to do a Star Trek book sometimes.
A horror Star Trek or just like sci-fi Star Trek?
You know, any kind. I could do any kind either. Long
I mean,
Star
they
Trek.
Got into some scary stuff.
Yeah,
so.
They sure did. When I was a kid, I really loved Kolchak the Night Stalker, reporter that would go after monsters every week. I got to do one little comic book short story for him, but I'd love to do more.
Let's talk about your nonfiction books. I will admit to being a huge fan of Writing in the Dark, which is about the craft of writing horror. It pulls from famous authors, your own years of experience. And one of my favorite pieces of advice was to take an everyday object or an everyday setting and imagine that something is wrong with it. Like if you're taking a walk in the woods this time of year and it's too quiet. No leaves are rustling, no animals are chittering, not even a gentle breeze blowing. That drawing attention to the stillness makes it creepy. And I love that.
Oh, yeah, I got that from that interview with Stephen King, because they asked him how he came up with his ideas, and he said that's what he does.
Yeah, and then if you were in that quiet forest and a twig snapped in the distance, that's scary, because the stillness is now normal.
Right.
I love it. It's such a neat way to think of, like, look at an object and decide what's wrong with it, like your ghost dachshund in the window.
Right, right. Well, horror comes from inside. So, you know, you have to be inside a character. And so it's the experience. Because if something like that happened and nobody was there, there's no horror.
I also think horror taps into our survival instincts. And that idea of working with something ordinary that's not ordinary, we're sort of biologically primed to react to things that don't fit the norm.
Yeah, and I think there's also a huge measure of, do we have control or not control? And especially as we get older, you know, kids don't have control over a lot of stuff, but adults think we do. And when you're put back in that position of being a kid and being kind of helpless, it's really hard for a lot of people. And I do think that can make for some of the best horror fiction.
Writing in the Dark also has a workbook. And there are chapters on how to create memorable characters, monsters, how to avoid cliches and tropes. What are some of the cliches where maybe we shouldn't do? Or if we do, we should subvert them and turn them on their heads.
Well, you know, using the tropes like a vampire or werewolf exactly the way they've always been used before. One of the things about horror is it focuses on the unknown. And once you know something well enough that you can have cartoon movies like Hotel Transylvania, which I love, but, you know, the tropes in there, they've lost their power. So what you need to do is find ways to reimagine them. So you played the, you know, some of Halloween. So Michael Myers, he's just the Grim Reaper trope, whether it was done on purpose or not. You know, it's what happened because he's got a skull type face. It's white. It's immobile. He's
in
monochromatic clothing. Yep. He shows a silent, shows up to reap your life, and he's got a knife that he reaps you with. And so nobody thinks Grim Reaper, but the power of the trope is there because you basically kind of just remade it or if nothing else, like put it in a new costume.
So like a vampire that's not a vampire.
Right.
I don't know what that would look like. I'll have to noodle on it. I'll let you know if I come up with it. You have another nonfiction book called Let Me Tell You a Story. And I'll admit I have not read it, but it is definitely on my to-be-read list. What is that one about?
What I did with that is I took short stories, horror short stories from throughout my career, from the earliest one I wrote, like when I was 18, to something I just finished, you know, in my late 50s. And I talked about where they came from, how I wrote them, and what I might do differently today. And I did it because those are the only stories I know exactly how they were made. And I wanted to go ahead also and kind of take a look back and say, okay, well, here's where I saw ableism in a story that I didn't even realize existed back then. It was so long ago. So, yeah, so it was kind of like a practice what you preach kind of writing book.
I like that too, because so often when we come to novels of any genre, we see the polished finished product, and it can be hard to imagine how you get there or even how you get there over time. You know, I was a print journalist before I was a radio host, and, you know, what I wrote my first year out of college is nowhere close to what I wrote in my 13th, 14th year.
Right. Yeah, it's very true.
And it's hard starting out to, you think you're doing the best you can with the information that you have.
Right. And there's no way to tell from a piece of finished writing how it was created. There's no way. You can't deconstruct it.
Mm-mm.
In terms of the process.
Yeah. So you also teach writing. You're a tenured professor who teaches creative writing and composition at Sinclair Community College in Dayton. How many of your students take the class because they're aspiring horror novelists?
A number.
I would think.
But not all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, a number of them do. The very first creative writing class I ever taught was at Columbus State, because I lived here for about 9 years before I got my job at Sinclair. And when I asked everybody what they wrote, because I made the mistake of saying I wrote horror, everybody, oh, I write horror too. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure you don't. But yeah, I do get a fair number of horror writers.
But I also think you can put scary moments into any kind of story. Every
right.
kind of story has scary moments.
Yeah, that's what's great about horror. It goes with everything. It's like ketchup. You can use as much as you want or as little, but it doesn't matter. It fits anything.
I mean, yeah, it's just about getting to that underlying emotion of what makes you afraid.
That's right. And in a lot of ways, it's like romance. I mean, they're sort of like different sides of the same coin because they focus on emotions, but different kinds.
Yeah, and you can put romance into any other genre.
That's right. Same thing. I think it's about the only one I can think of that probably is like horror. It goes with everything.
You're not dropping fantasy into any kind of book or
right.
historical fiction.
Right. But you can always have romance and you can always have elements of horror.
In your teens, you say that you read Lawrence Block's column on fiction writing in Writer's Digest. How do you think that shaped you as a writer?
Oh, hugely. The writing in the dark books wouldn't exist without that. And the voice I use in that is, it's not exactly his, but he would use just sort of a warm kind of, you know, here I am talking to you voice. And I thought that worked really, really well. And I learned so much from those. So and all those, a lot of those columns are collected in various books that he has. So if anybody wants to check them out, just, you know, lawrenceblock.com.
And if anybody wants to check you out, where do we find you?
TimWagner.com.
Simple, straightforward. We've also tagged him on Instagram, Twitter, in our Facebook, so you can just click through very easily and find him in all of his work. Very difficult question for you here at the end. Do you have a favorite novel or short story that you've written?
Oh, I hate this question. the short story, probably, and it's in my Let Me Tell You a Story. It's a story called Mr. Punch. And I came up with seeing a Punch and Judy show at OSU during a festival.
Oh.
And it was the first story that was my story that I wrote. I actually got about two-thirds of the way through and stopped because it was so good I was afraid I'd screw it up. But it became my first published story. And since I think of that as the first Tim Wagner short story, the first story from my voice, that one's my favorite.
Oh, I'm going to have to pick up Let Me Tell You a Story. I remember Punch and Judy from Gone Girl, so it automatically has like a connotation mm-hmm. of like creepy and unsettling. So I think that's a good one. Have you read any good horror fiction that's not yours lately?
Well, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier, and I said Eric LaRocca's books are really, really good. I really enjoy his. Bentley Little's books are a lot of fun. He comes up with some very strange premises, which I love, because you just don't know what's going to happen because of it. So,
you to be surprised by a horror novel, that's high praise.
Well, yeah, you know, it's one of the things you look for. Probably anybody who reads after anything for long enough, you look for something that's a little bit new, a little bit different, something you can learn from.
That's writer and professor Tim Wagoner. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me here.
Coming up, R.L. Stine shares how he's made a career giving kids goosebumps. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Over the last 30 years, this author's books have been a horror staple among young readers. Millions have hidden under their covers, reading his books with a flashlight. His stories about haunted masks and ventriloquist dummies come to life have made R.L. Stine one of the best-selling children book series authors of all time. Mr. Stine, welcome to All Sides.
Well, thank you, Anna. Nice to be here. You know, I'm just back from Columbus.
Yeah. I grew up on your books, so I still remember reading Say Cheese and Die for the very first time and being terrified.
That's my job.
Yeah. So you were born in Columbus, grew up in Bexley. How did your upbringing and Central Ohio shape the writer you became?
Well, that's a hard question. I'm not really sure. I grew up on the very edge of Bexley, and there are all these mansions all around us, very rich people. And my family was very poor. We lived in a tiny brick house, three doors from the railroad tracks. And I think the fact that I was, you know, I think I didn't feel like I fit in. And it made me an outsider, I think. Just the fact that our family was so poor compared to everyone else. And I think that's made me sort of an observer, an outsider. And that's part of why I became a writer. Sorry, I hate giving such a serious answer. But
no,
mainly the main contribution to Bexley is that almost every Goosebumps book takes place in a backyard. They don't take place in a castle in middle Europe. They don't take place in exotic locations. They're all suburban. And when I do write the Goosebumps books, I remember my backyard in Bexley. So they all pretty much take place there.
You started writing stories when you were nine. Did you start with scary stuff or did that come later?
Oh, no, I never planned to be scary. I never planned to be a scary writer. I was only funny. I'm in my room typing joke books, little joke books, comic books. And I was funny my whole career. The story is embarrassing. It wasn't even my idea to be scary. It was someone else's idea. So I was just funny.
So who suggested you be scary?
Well, I was... I did a humor magazine for 10 years for kids called Bananas, and I wrote all kinds of joke books. And the magazine closed, and one day I was having lunch with this woman, Jean Fywell, who was the publisher at Scholastic.
Mm.
And she arrived at lunch angry. She'd had a fight with a guy who wrote teen horror, who shall remain nameless, Christopher Pike. she said, I'm never working with him again. You could write a good book, a good teen horror book. Go home and write a book called Blind Date. She even gave me the title. And I didn't know what's a teen horror book. I had no idea what she was talking about. But in those days, you know, I never said no to anything. You always just say yes. And I ran to the bookstore and I bought books by Christopher Pike and Lois Duncan and Diane Ho and Richie Tankersley. These people were all writing teen horror. And I read so I could find out what she was talking about. I wrote this book, Blind Date. It was a number one bestseller. I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? A year later, I wrote one called Twisted, another number one bestseller. And I said, forget the funny stuff. I've been scary ever since.
I love it. It's such a, I love how fate just intervenes sometimes in completely unexpected ways.
No, everything that ever happened to me was an accident. No, you're right. You're right. It's fate. I had nothing to do with any of it.
You also said, though, that growing up, you were a fearful child. So you were afraid of lots of different things. And I think that probably helps, because if you can reimagine what it felt like to be terrified at 10, then you can recreate that feeling for readers.
That's right. It was a terrible way to be a kid, to be afraid of things, so many things. But later, when I started to write this stuff, I could draw, I could remember that feeling of panic, and I could put it into the books. So it turned out to be helpful, but it wasn't a good way to grow up.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm still afraid of the dark. So some things we never grow out of.
Well, most people are afraid of the dark. Come on.
Maybe it's all the Goosebumps books I read as a kid. They were a huge
hit. No, you're blaming me.
No.
Yes, you are. Going to send me your shrink bills, aren't you?
No. I went from you to Stephen King, to grabbing my mother's Stephen King books in high school to, you know, Darcy Coates and Alma Katsu. And I'm just a big fan of the horror genre now. And I think it all started with the Goosebumps books.
Sorry. That's nice you mentioned Alma. I know Alma.
Oh, you do? I love The Hunger.
What?
The Hunger? I thought that the reimagining of the Donner Party. Yeah, it was fantastic.
I was on the board of International Thriller Writers for years. This is my grown-up life. And Alma was on the board, too. We got to know each other pretty well. She's a very good writer.
Yeah.
That's so nice to mention to her.
How do you know if your stories are the right amount of scary for kids? Because, I mean, adult horror, it's totally different from the Goosebumps books.
It's just, well, I've been doing it 400 years. So that, you know, that helps a lot. You can experiment. I tend to be fairly conservative. My editors are always saying, hype it up, make it scarier. They're always pushing me more. But here's my one rule, to be serious, for Goosebumps. The reader has to know that it's a fantasy. They have to know that it couldn't really happen. And if I establish that in the book, I can go pretty far with the scares, because they know it's not real. Also, every book has a happy ending.
Yeah. And you don't always get that in adult fiction or in real life.
No, you don't. Well, you know, once I, just for fun, I was in my other series, Fear Street, for teenagers. I wrote a book with an unhappy ending, just fun for me, you know. And in the end of that book, the good girl is taken away as a murderer, and the murderer gets off scot-free. And this book came out. Sorry. This book came out. It was, I think, called The Best Friend. And kids hated it. And they turned on me immediately. And I started getting mail. R.L. Stine, you moron. R.L. Stine, you idiot. How could you write that? How could you write that? Are you going to write a sequel to finish the story? they could not accept an unhappy ending. I never did it again.
I say one of my favorites was the horror at Camp Jelly Jam.
Yeah, mine too.
Oh, that's my great.
My smelliest book. I love that.
It was so gross and creepy.
And smelly. You know, the monster had to be bathed 24 hours a day because he smelled so bad. But people are always asking me to do a sequel.
Yeah.
But I don't know how I would do it.
Yeah, that's a good question.
He did, you know, he died from his own smell. I just gave away the ending.
That's okay. I feel like when a book has been out for at least a year, if it's spoiled at this point, well.
And do you believe 32 years of Goosebumps?
Oh my, well.
Do you believe that? When we started out, I said, let's do two or three.
Yeah. Well, I'm 40. So yeah, they've kind of just, I grew up with them. I can remember them at the Scholastic book fairs and that kind of thing.
You're the right age.
I am the right age for this.
We got those 90s kids.
Yeah. You also have a graphic novel coming out. You're redoing some of the Goosebumps as graphic novels?
No, Scholastic is. I'm not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, Scholastic is taking some of my stories and but I have my own, you know, I'm doing my own comic books.
Mm.
I have my whole new comic book career. And my new graphic novel for teenagers just came out. It's called The Graveyard Club.
Oh.
Boom Studios out in L.A. And about these kids who live in such a boring, horrible town, the only place they can hang out is the graveyard. And then bad things start to happen.
I do two
of these graveyard clubs. I have my own graphic novels.
No, that sounds great. My kids are probably a little young for that. We'll get there soon.
How old?
10 and 7.
Oh, good age.
Yeah.
Good age. My grandson Dylan is 10. And Dylan, I did a book signing at Barnes & Noble here in New York about a month ago, and Dylan came. And all the time I was talking, he read Wings of Fire. He read someone else's book all the time I was talking. And then afterwards, our 10-year-olds, really, I said, Dylan, did you like the ghost story I told? And he said, I liked it when you told it last year.
Ooh.
That's tough, right?
That's a tough room.
Yes.
Do you like to read horror in your downtime?
Can you keep a secret?
Sure.
No one's listening, right?
No, not at all.
I'm not really into horror. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, what do you read in your spare time?
Mysteries and thrillers mostly. I was in the, you know, all the big thriller writers are friends of mine. Mm. Michael Connelly and Lee Child and Harlan Coben. You know, I know these are the people I read. I read mostly mysteries and thrillers and a lot of current fiction. I don't read any nonfiction. I hate anything real.
You know,
true.
I read a lot of horror and dark fantasy and sci-fi. And as somebody who covers politics for a living, I always, like, there's some joke to be made there, but it's escapism for me.
Yes, it's escape. Of course. It's a very scary world.
Yeah. Do you?
I know. It's better to have it in books.
So then what's the best book you've read recently?
Oh, the best book I've read recently was Shanghai by Joseph Cannon, K-A-N-O-N. He's an amazing spy writer, thriller writer. Now that Le Carré is gone, he's our best spy writer. It's like beautifully written, not a spare word, and just dread on every page, terrible dread every page. He's really, he's a wonderful writer. That's the best book I've read for a while.
I'll have to check that out.
I love the Thursday Murder Club books.
Mm.
Have you read those?
I have not.
Yes. Those are really charming, wonderful books. Richard Osman.
I'll have to check them out, that too. I'm a sucker for word economy in books, so I'll definitely have to check the first one out.
He's a really good writer.
I was struck by something that you said this summer to the New York Times, that you see your books as enablers for kids, that the goal isn't to terrify them so much as give them a creepy adventure in which they confront the monsters or ghosts or aliens. The idea is the fear enables the win. And I kind of love that. I think that's why we like being scared in the first place, as practice.
Yeah, I think so. But the other thing is, I think a lot of my readers identify with the monsters. You know, don't you? Kids feel like monsters a lot of the time, right? They get angry, they're frustrated, they can't do what they want. They want to roar, they want to jump. And I honestly think a lot of kids identify with the monsters as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about my books, we always said, oh, they're safe scares, because kids know what they're in for. They're safe in their room reading while they're fighting these horrible things. And it always lets you off safe, every book.
Yeah, I think if you like the monsters in Goosebumps, you graduate to morally gray protagonists and antiheroes as an adult.
I think you're right.
Yeah. You also have a scholarship here at Ohio State for creative writing. How did that come about? You're a graduate,
yes.
Right, of OSU?
They asked me, I think. That's how anything
happens.
As simple
happens. And as straightforward, yeah.
Right? No, I just thought it'd be a nice thing, you know, creative writing students there to pay their tuition for a year and give them the chance to work on their writing. And I'm very proud of that, actually.
So I once read this book called Writing in the Dark, and it was all about tips for writing scary stories. And Stephen King's tip was, something is not right here. You start with an ordinary object and you just think about how it's not right or what could be wrong with it.
That's good.
Yeah, I really liked it. And playing that game of like thinking about like a walk in the woods and what could make it wrong and not right and spooky. But
right.
What would be your tip for writing a scary story?
Oh, I don't know. My tip is, by the way, I have my own book on writing scary books. It's called There's Something Wrong with My Brain.
Oh, I like that title.
65 tips for writing scary books. For me, I would say that surprises is the most important thing. And that's what I work hard on. You know, I think the shock, the surprise, that's what people like. So much of children's literature is very linear, and it just goes in a straight line, and it's pretty predictable. But what I like to do, I like halfway through the book or two-thirds, there's some big surprise, some twist, and the reader says, oh, no, I didn't know that. I didn't understand. I had no idea that's what was going on. The Goosebumps movie, where Jack Black played me, there's a line in that movie that Jack says that I wish I had written. He's teaching a class at the end of the movie, and Jack says, every story has a beginning, a middle, and a twist. I wish I'd written that line.
It is a good line.
It's really what I do.
That was horror author R.L. Stine. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it. Stay scary, Anna.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. Coming up, it's a jump to the left and a step to the right with the director of a local Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're closing out our Halloween Fascinating Ohio with a Halloween tradition. If you don't recognize the song, that's Time Warp from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. a horror comedy film that has a cult classic following, a following that has inspired special screenings and productions of the original stage play, The Rocky Horror Show. I'm joined by Edward Kerrigan, producing artistic director of Short North Stage. Welcome to All Sides, Edward.
Hi. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. You're also the director and choreographer of Short North Stage's production of The Rocky Horror Show, which has been running all month long. How did you get involved?
Oh, well, Rocky Horror has been a part of my life since I was a teenager. I remember seeing it the first time. I remember having a special Halloween party on my 16th birthday for it. And then I've directed it all over the country 12 times, 7 times here in Columbus at Short North Stage.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So you are a late October, early November baby then?
Well, no, I had a July birthday, but we had a special Rocky Horror party in July. I remember that very well.
Like Christmas in July.
Exactly.
So this is the 7th year Short North Stage is putting on the Rocky Horror Show. How did the tradition get started here in Columbus?
Well, before I started as the artistic director here, I had directed it for a few other theaters, and it's always been very popular. I love Rocky Horror because it's this cross-generation sort of piece that's been passed down year after year from mom to son or father to son or, you know, older aunt or uncle. And it's sort of just it makes everybody happy at Halloween. And I thought, well, we have to bring that to Columbus. I know they have shadow casts here, but a live production is totally unique. And we were right. We produced it 7 years ago. It ran for 8 weeks that first year. And then we just kept bringing it back as a tradition.
How many more weeks is it going to be on? No.
Sadly, this is our closing weekend. We have one tonight, 2 tomorrow, 1 at 11 o'clock tomorrow night, 1 at 7, and then 2 on Saturday, and that's the end of it.
There any tickets left?
There are tickets left, yes.
So if you've been putting it off, now is your moment.
Yeah, and it's most fun seeing it on Halloween for sure.
Especially if you've never seen it in person. Like, I got really lucky. I grew up in, like, a suburb of New York City, essentially. So I got to go see it, like, the off-Broadway production of it, where the actor, they have a row of, like, actors acting as audience, and they do the call and response.
Yeah, that's the best part of it. I mean, the audience is the most important cast member. We always say that because it's one of the only shows where you can go and what you say or what you decide to say that night or throw on the stage is totally unique and different than the night before. So it's always a really fresh experience when you come see Rocky.
Have you ever acted in the play?
Yeah, actually, when I used to be a performer in New York, my first couple of years as a performer, I worked and was a Brad and a Frankenfurter and an ensemble member. So I've done the show a few times, but I most love just sitting back and watching a run of it.
Frankenfurter is a big pair of shoes to step into.
Yeah, big pair of heels, for sure.
Yeah, he, like... It's such an iconic character. It's such a loud and brash and out there character. Is it hard trying to step into the shoes knowing that the audience has a certain expectation?
You know, Nick Harden, who's been playing it for us for 7 years, is a brilliant Frankenfurter because he really knows how to marry both the ideas that you come in with from Tim Curry, of course, but then also bring a fresh take on the role. What I love that Nick always says is the most important thing about Frankenfurter is that he's a great hostess.
It is. You know what's funny to me is the film was initially a flop when it came out in 1975, but now it's one of the biggest cult classic films.
Yeah, it's the only piece of cinema never to leave the movie theaters since 1975. Isn't that amazing? Like, it's been playing in some theater, either at a midnight showing or as a mainstream thing at Halloween for 50 years now. And it's created an audience larger than any other musical I can think of.
I know. I came to it in my teens, and it's been a minute since I was a teenager.
Me too.
It's crazy to think that, you could go see Rocky Horror live on stage or in a movie theater pretty much my whole life.
Yeah, it is a really a unique thing that has made Halloween special for me for the past 20 years of my career. Yeah, if I'm not working on the show or not in the show, I always make a point to go see it somewhere. So,
are the guests at the Short North production, are they allowed to dress up?
They absolutely are encouraged to dress up. We have participation bags for sale in the lobby, and then callbacks are welcome, but also just leaded by our phantoms. So if you don't know them, you'll learn a few extra ones when you come see it.
This is a difficult question. Do you have a favorite song or scene from Rocky Horror?
A favorite song? Well, I've always loved the Time Warp.
It's a classic.
It is. And it was really fun to choreograph because trying to think of just, you know, it gives you the steps and the lyrics. How do you do something different from the film, but also make sure that it follows what the song is about? And I've had a lot of fun reworking that this year, especially. And then we do the traditional version at the end of the show so the audience can join in and do the part that they know. So,
oh, so you get two different versions.
You get two different time warps, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but like, can you give us a hint about what sort of changes you've made?
Well, just the choreography in general. A jump to the left can mean a lot of things. A step to the right can mean a lot of things. So I had to sort of like think creatively about what else could that be. But knowing that our audiences come and love the original Time Warp choreography from the film, we make sure to do that at the end of the show too. So you get something new and fresh, and then you get something you love. And I think that's kind of what Rocky Horror is. It's a marrying of things you love and our traditions, and then also experiences and ways to view the show that you hadn't thought about before.
So it sounds like the show changes a little bit every year. Does the rehearsal process, the sets, like how do you conceptualize it?
Well, it's been an amazing journey at Short North Stage. We put the show up now in a week and a half because most of our cast returned. So it's more of a brush up than anything. This year, I decided to re-choreograph a lot of stuff just to keep it fresh. But every year, it's been totally different. We had a pandemic year where there were mannequins in the audience to create social distancing for us. We've done it in our black box space a few times, so a really intimate version. And now it's on our main stage. We try to change up the set and add new lighting elements every year. And the cast changes. There's minor changes every year. There's actually quite a few new performers this year that are exceptionally talented. But of course, Nick Harden has been the glue that's held it all together for 7 years. And I think audiences come to see his Frankenfurter especially.
Yeah, no, but all the characters are so iconic, from Janet to Brad to everybody.
Yes, yes. And Riff and Magenta and Columbia and Rocky and the narrator. I mean, it's such a great cast of characters, and I've really enjoyed working on it every year.
I know we're talking a lot about Rocky Horror, but can you share what you have coming up for the rest of this Short North Stage season? Ooh, that was a tongue twister.
Well, absolutely. We're very excited. We start rehearsal next week for Jersey Boys, which our associate artistic director, Dionysia Williams, will be directing. I will be down at the Ohio Theater directing A Christmas Carol for our second year on Thanksgiving weekend. And then we move into the new year with one of my very favorite musicals, Nine, which is a very sexy romantic story about Venice in the 1960s. Then we move on to A Chorus Line, another show I've had a lot of experience with in our career and is just an audience favorite. We haven't done it in 10 years. My first season here, we're bringing it back. And then we're finishing off our season with The Drowsy Chaperone, which is a hilarious send-up of musical comedy in the 1920s.
I've never heard of that one.
Oh, it's so much fun. Hilarious.
So it sounds like that'll be like late spring-ish.
Yeah, that'll be like May.
All right, I'll have to circle back to that. Yeah, I know absolutely nothing about it, so I'll have to
Google
it later.
Oh, you'll love it. Go in blind and you'll just laugh for 2 hours.
That's a good sell. Yeah. I mean, Rocky Horror 2, I mean, it's a kind of a laugh out loud show.
It is. It's kind of evolved to sort of be a parody of itself over the years, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it is sort of a B movie in its own right. And then now the productions sort of, you know, poke fun at the things that were really interesting in 1975, and we've evolved to look back at it and think, well, that's hilarious. So
it's very campy.
It's so campy.
But in all the best ways.
In the best ways.
What's it like getting to look out and see the audience experience the show and interact with the cast?
Well, everyone always says, you know, what's your favorite part about being an artistic director? And I have to say, it's just being able to sit in the audience and watch a group of people enjoy something you've put your hard work into. I think Dionysia, my associate, and I both talk about that all the time. Like, there's nothing that beats that feeling of an audience just uproariously laughing at something or really coming out enthralled by a performance or drawn into the drama of something they've never seen before but are so thrilled that they came out to the theater to see that night and we're happy that we were able to introduce them to something new. I think that's the best part of this whole thing. So I love that. I love sitting in the audience. I have to say I watch Rocky Horror probably every single night for the past 7 years. I just sit in the back and enjoy.
And you never get tired of it.
Well, it's always different. Every night is different. You know, we never know what's going to happen. We never know what the audience is going to do. And I think that's what makes Rocky so unique and special.
Is there a show you've always wanted to direct or really hope to bring to the stage in the future?
Yeah, nine. We're getting to do it. We've been talking about doing it for almost 10 years, my entire time here, and nine. I got exposed to it when I was living in New York in the revival in 2003 with Antonio Banderas. And I went back, I think, three or four times to see it. I just was so enchanted by the beautiful score and how amazing the staging was. And I've always wanted to tackle it. And this year we finally get to. So this January, February, please take a chance. Come out and see something you probably aren't familiar with, because you'll probably love it as much as I do.
Do you guys use the same costumes for Rocky Horror year after year?
Well, I'm also the costume designer. I have a background in costume and scenic
design. Oh my goodness, you wear many
hats. Yes, but I like to change it up every year. So we have some core ideas, glam rock ideas that have kind of carried through the entire 7 years that we've been working on it. But always we try to get new floor show costumes. We try to make sure Frank has some new bling and some new wigs. And, you know, I never want an audience member that has come every 7 years to think, oh, well, this again. I want them to always be surprised by something they see on stage.
Yeah, that's interesting, because there are some iconic moments, like when Brad and Janet end up in their underpants, and you just sort of expect that to happen at some point in, I guess it's not a spoiler, it's been out for 50
years.
Yeah,
it's not a spoiler. But this year they all come out in new floor show costumes, so that's been really fun to redesign this year.
What about their makeup? Now, I used to have a friend in New York City who was in Cats, and I was shocked that he did his own makeup, that they taught him how to do it, and then he did his own.
Yeah, that's pretty standard now. I mean, occasionally, you know, I did the Young Frankenstein tour about 13 years ago, and, you know, they teach you, and there are people that help you, but when you go on as the monster, you got to do an hour and a half of your green makeup every night, and the actors in the show, they all
That's
do
a lot
their,
of scrubbing after you're done.
A lot of scrubbing, especially on a two-show day. But all of our actors do their own makeup, and I've got to say, it's pretty impressive. Our inspiration is just mid-70s glam rock. That's kind of their only guiding force. So they do some research, I send them some research, and they make their plots, and I love that they're all original and new every year with the different actors.
Yeah, my husband and I went as black and white film stars 1 year.
Fun.
Yeah, that was an insane amount of scrubbing before we could go to bed. I was like, okay.
You know, drag is such an amazing art form, and not the least of which is because of the makeup and how much time and effort it takes to do drag well. So I'm always so impressed, not only by our Rocky actors, but all of my friends that are drag queens, because I think, my goodness, you know, we see the final product, but I know 2 hours of prep went into all that.
And then like an hour of unprep.
Unprep and moisturizing.
I was wondering if I could get your take on the future of small theater companies like yours.
Well, I think now is a really exciting time to be a regional theater. You know, for years and years, workshops and out-of-town tryouts were the way that shows were created for Broadway. Now you see more and more theaters like La Jolla or ART or Paper Mill creating shows that end up on Broadway, and they get their first run out of town in a city like Columbus. And I want Short North Stage to be that. I mean, we're still growing. We're still relatively small as a professional regional theater. But as we grow, I want it to be a place that Columbus can be proud of, and then maybe eventually we send a show to New York, and we can all in Columbus be like, that started here, that started in our hometown. And I think that's what's really cool about working in the regional theater right now, is it's an important time.
Oh, that's so cool. So playwrights, listen up. They're looking for the next Broadway hit.
Yes, we need the next Broadway musical, something funny,
Rocky Horror.
Yeah, the next Rocky Horror, exactly.
I don't know what that would be. I guess we won't know it until it hits.
You probably won't know for 50 years if it's a cult classic or not.
And if it follows tradition, it'll flop initially.
Yeah, which is fine, right? As long as the ends justify the means.
One more time, I was hoping you could remind us where we can get tickets, when the final weekend of shows is going to happen.
Absolutely. This is the final weekend. One tonight at 7, one at 7 and 11 tomorrow, and 5 and 9 on Saturday. That's our closing. You can get tickets at shortnorthstage.org, as well as cbusarts.com, and you can get tickets to all the shows in our season, as well as Christmas Carol at the Ohio at cbusarts.com as well.
That was Edward Carignan, director and choreographer of the Rocky Horror Show and producing artistic director at Short North Stage. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. And thanks to our producers, Marcus Charleston, Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our intern producers, Chris Corcoran, David Stein, and Kira Kadar. Have a safe and happy, and maybe a little spooky, Halloween. Thanks for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.